Yeah. Election time's coming. Who you gonna vote for? Yeah. If I was president, I'd get elected on Friday. Assassinated on Saturday. Buried on Sunday. They go back to work on Monday. If I was president, if I was president, if I was president, yeah.
Wyclef Jean says that The Score, the multi-platinum album he made with the hip-hop trio The Fugees, was the soundtrack of his relationship with the group's frontwoman, Lauryn Hill. But for many of the Fugees fans, that record represented the soundtrack of an entire era. And it skyrocketed Mr. Jean and his bandmates to international fame. In the years since, the singer-songwriter has released solo albums and even flirted with running for president of Haiti. Purpose, an immigrant story, his memoir written with Anthony Boza, is about his remarkable experiences as a musician and about his journey to the United States, where he grew up in rough neighborhoods in Brooklyn and Newark. Wyclef Jean was on our show in September to talk about his memoir, and we are re-airing that interview for you now. He opened the book with a description of his trip to Haiti after the devastating earthquake, and I asked him, what did you find after you touched down in Port-au-Prince just hours after the catastrophe? Were you going there simply as an observer, or were you also concerned because you'd left people behind?
Well, for me, before the earthquake, I was constantly in Haiti. So whether if it was Gonaïve and a whole city going underwater, I was in there with my boots helping, whether if it was getting kids back to school. So naturally, this is where I'm from, because sometimes what happens, people be like, when's the last time you went to Haiti? I said, well, that's like somebody being from Jamaica, you know, like this is where we naturally from. The minute I heard about that, I had to be there the very next day. And as I start the book, I would say one of the hardest things, the most painful thing that an individual could do is knowing that another individual is about to pass away and is about to dismiss from earth and about to die. And you have to exit that person and let them know that everything's going to be okay. So I think that probably was one of the hardest things, to find myself in a position where someone is asking for an ambulance and they're asking for a doctor. And I know that there's no doctors around and there's no ambulance around, and I'm peacefully trying to get them to close their eyes.
In fact, it seems that that was the biggest problem. The space is designed to provide aid to people in a disaster. The hospitals, the warehouses where supplies were stored had all been destroyed.
Had all been destroyed, and hotels were turning into clinics. The fields of hotels were turning into morgues. So this is some of the setting of what I walked into.
And it sounds like a frantic 48 hours. In that short time, you saved a girl who was buried under a mound of rubble. You moved corpses to proper burial sites and even tried to hunt down gang members who shot and killed one of your closest friends in the looting that followed the quake. Were other people doing the same sort of thing? I mean, was it that desperate that everybody had to pitch in, or were most people just stunned by what had happened?
It looked to me as if Haiti had a million eyes at the time. So there's a million different stories of the quake, and it seemed everyone was pitching in and doing their part.
Well, what about today? Haiti, the rebuilding effort has still suffered a lot of setbacks, hasn't it?
Yeah, a lot of the setbacks when we talk about setbacks, I also talk of setbacks, then I talk of progress. So let's talk about the setbacks first. One of the things was, we knew, looking at situations like Iraq, for example, and we say, okay, well, you know, we'll go in and we rebuild. Situations like Katrina, for example, when we say, okay, we'll go in and we rebuild. The tsunami. So even if you go through New Orleans, the idea of 250,000 people under a rubble coming up with a structure where you basically going to set up housing and regroup people, it's not an easy process to do. That's the first thing.
You wind up with a lot of tent cities. Some of them still exist.
Yeah. But in Port-au-Prince now, the tents are basically out of a lot of parts of Port-au-Prince, which is starting to be great progress for what's going on now.
Now, let's talk about your childhood. Was it unusual that you were raised by your aunt and uncle until you were 10 because your parents were in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, for me at the time, I didn't know. Like I said, I thought my aunt was my mom. I called her my mom. And when they, like, at times they would be like, you know, your parents send you a bicycle or something. And I would always think it's an imaginary parent. You know what I mean? Like, there was actually my actual mom and dad. I mean, it felt natural. They showed me nothing but love.
And why didn't your parents bring you with them when they came to the United States?
Well, my dad first, he came on a Christian Nazarene visa as a minister to basically come to the States to preach the gospel. When his visa ran out, he decided that he wasn't going to go back again. He went underground. And so his idea was to bring my mom from Haiti. And at the time, I can't recall who was the president, but the law was if you had a child in America, automatically the kid became a citizen. That was the plan. After they had two kids, then they became U.S. citizens, and they basically came back to Haiti to get me and my brother.
Now, the Nazarene Church, common is it for somebody to be a member of it in Haiti? Haiti is a Catholic country, and then it has this other tradition, which you discuss in this book, the voodoo tradition. Mm-hmm. Is the Nazarene Church also an important religious force?
Yeah, Protestant. Mm-hmm. So we do have Protestants. We have Catholics, which of course, but now we also have the Protestant faith, and we have the voodoo faith. And so Nazarene would fall under the category of Nazarene Baptist Church of God, yes.
And your father, you say, his decision to become a Christian minister was controversial in the family because it meant breaking with the voodoo tradition that his father practiced. Prevalent is voodoo still in Haiti?
I mean, it's very, I mean, it's part of everyday life. And the stereotype of the voodoo that we see in Hollywood, that's not what the voodoo is. The actual voodoo, it's practiced as a religion,
and more like Santeria for Cubans.
Yeah, well, it's from African roots, and you know it worships God, similar
to what the Santeria religion.
Well, Santeria,
that's a syncretic religion. It mixes Christianity with the Yoruban.
Yeah, it mixes Christianity with the African ancestors. But keep in mind, though, with the voodoo, because when you had the revolution, remember, when you had the Haitian Revolution, this was part of what got us our revolution.
So your father comes here and actually succeeds. And this seems to be a pattern in your family. The son defies his father and in the process finds success on his own.
Yeah, so my dad definitely, his plan was for me to become a minister. With a name like Wycliffe John, he clearly. And then I defined what he wanted me to do when it was time for me to go to Eastern Nazarene College. They was looking for me to get on the bus, and I was nowhere to be found.
You just hidden?
Yeah, I mean, I basically ran away. Like, I did not want to go on that bus, and I didn't want to be part of the Eastern Nazarene College at the time.
My guess is Wycliffe Jean, his memoir is called Purpose, An Immigrant Story. But your father also had been supportive of the fact that you'd wanted to be a musician. Didn't he buy instruments for you and your siblings?
Yeah.
Although not the kind of music that you went into.
No, he bought the instruments so I could become, like, we could become the church band. Mm-hmm. So he had other plans with the instruments that he bought. It just backfired on him.
And your way of dealing with that was to stick a couple of religious references into anything that you were working on?
Yeah, so what happened was at the time, the church did not speak English too well. It was mostly Creole was the language. And so me and my brothers, we used to always sneak and listen to a lot of rock music. And the reason why we like rock was we was listening to bands like Petra, Stryper, and it was more like Christian groups. But then we started getting into like Metallica, Guns N' Roses, you know, Led Zeppelin, Eddie Van Halen solos. And so once in a while, being that the congregation did not speak English, so we would always get, as long as my dad heard Jesus, and so we would take a song and be like, you know, go ahead, jump, jump for Jesus Christ. Yeah. You know what I mean? Long as you put in Jesus' name in it, it was fine with my dad.
And so you're really speaking three languages at this point. Yeah. Creole at home, I assume.
Yes.
French, sometimes within the Haitian community. Mm-hmm. And you're 10 years old. You come to Brooklyn. Coney Island is where you grew up initially?
Yeah, Coney Island, Marlboro Hill Projects, where I got my first hot dog, Oscar Mayer.
So then you felt like you were a real American, didn't you?
Yeah, I got that Oscar Mayer. It was incredible.
You also tell this great story about the time you came across a drum that was supposedly possessed. This is while you were still living in Haiti. Can you tell us what happened with that?
Well, I mean, you know, it was sort of like a voodoo drum. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had to go to the pastor and everything. But what happens is, still, if you go to the village where I come from, or if, like, you Google me when I did 60 Minutes, I think it goes back to that place. And no matter, even though we had the house, there was always a small voodoo temple in the back, you know? So it was sort of like, once again, those stories where it's like the Protestant minister versus the priest, you know, the voodoo priest at the time.
And so, your father, where was he in all of this? Did he totally reject voodoo?
Yes, he totally rejected voodoo, yes, mm-hmm. And became a minister.
And this is in a small town. This is, you weren't growing up in Port-au-Prince.
No, I grew up, like, I call it the Hut City, in a place outside of Port-au-Prince called La Serre. It was very dirt city. I remember candles as electricity. Remember going to school on a donkey, you know, things like that. We was definitely there.
So it must have been a total culture shock when you came to the United States. And Coney Island can be a culture shock even for people in the United States. Mm-hmm. What were your first impressions?
I mean, it was cool. You know, sometimes when I watch the Godfather movie, the original, and then when they go back home, you know, and you see, like, the donkeys, you see the, and then you see, like, when they were getting off the boat in America. It just was a, it's like, it, you go, like, from night to day, you know, it's pretty, because you're not speaking the language, you don't understand the language, you see all these lights on the streets, you see all these cars, you see all these people moving. For a second, like, you know, you have some kind of fear figuring out where are you at.
Were there other Haitian kids in your school?
Where we was growing up, it wasn't a lot. It was probably like six or seven of us.
Hmm. So at the time, you were really an outsider in more ways than one.
Yeah, beyond an outsider. And this is why we sort of like got involved with hip hop at an early age, because it was the only form of culture that would accept us to be able to go and dance and sing and do different things.
My guest is Wyclef Jean. His book, written with the help of Anthony Bosa, is called Purpose, An Immigrant Story. It is published by It Books, and we will come back and talk a bit about hip-hop and related matters after we take a little break. Stay with us.
Go.
Now that I escape, sleep, walk, awake. Yeah. Those who correlate know the world ain't cake. Jail bars ain't golden gates. Those who fake, they break. When they meet their 400-pound mate, if I can rule the world.
Later on in the show, director Penny Marshall talks about her life and career in front of and behind the camera. And then in our second hour, Linda Hirschman tells the story of the gay rights movement in this country. And Joan Rivers explains why she says she hates everyone, starting with herself. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast, and you can find me on Facebook and Twitter.
WNYC support comes from Columbia University School of Continuing Education, offering courses and certificate programs for graduate school prep, academic, and professional advancement. Application and information for January 2013 enrollment at ce.columbia.edu/WNYC. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance journalism excellence in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org. LV Wood Floors, specializing in custom pre-finished wood flooring and reclaimed wood flooring made to the client's specifications, all sustainably made in the USA. The New York City showroom on 20th Street between 5th and 6th Avenue is open to the public. LVWoodFloors.com.
This year, WNYC's Martin Luther King Day celebration is inspired by A. Peter Bailey's play, Malcolm, Martin, and Medgar, which imagines a reunion of the slain civil rights icons. I'm Brian Lehrer. Join me and Farai Shadea for an afternoon of discussion and staged readings, Sunday, January 20th at the Brooklyn Museum. Sponsored in part by Brooklyn Community Foundation, admission is free. RSVP at events at WNYC.org.
Tell my girl you are gone till November, January, February, March, April, May. I see you crying, but girl, I can't stay. I'll be gone till November, I'll be gone till November. And give a kiss to my mother. When I come back, there'll be no need to clock.
We're back with an interview I did in September with Wyclef Jean, a former member of the hip-hop trio The Fugees. He's also sold over 50 million albums as a solo artist, a sideman, and a producer, working with people like Whitney Houston, Michael Jackson, Carlos Santana, Eric Clapton, Paul Simon, Mary J. Blige, and Destiny's Child. And he's written a memoir called Purpose, an Immigrant Story, with the help of Anthony Boza. We're replaying an interview I did with Mr. Jean in September. I asked him, when you started to become interested in hip-hop, did rapping come naturally to you, someone for whom English is not the first language?
Well, the way that it came natural for me was the dialect and the rhythms that they were doing, being that I couldn't speak English, sort of like right now if my daughter is 7. And the shows that are in Nickelodeon are different. It's sort of like there's actually hip-hop shows now which
really
teach kids English through beats and through rhythm. And so for me at an early age, not knowing how to speak English and listening to something that sounds like this, the hip, the hop, the hip-hip-hip-hip-hip-hop, you don't stop. It just was enticing to me. So even though I didn't know English, I can start learning these words.
Well, it seems to me that people who speak French and Spanish actually have a better time doing hip-hop than people who speak some other languages. The languages, because they have their own rhythmic aspects, mm-hmm. probably make it easier. I don't know whether Creole plays a part in that as well.
Well, actually, now there is Creole rap. But there's really just wanted to explain. So hip-hop is sort of like the culture. So it was like the acceptance, the clothes, the vibe. And then rap was one form of the music inside of the culture.
You say that a classmate named Chili Rob G taught you how to rap when you were in middle school.
Yeah.
And then you went by the name Nelly Nell. Probably not the best name for a rapper. That was based on your middle name.
I'm going to sample your voice for my album, man. Yo, you went by Nelly Nell. Not the best name for a rapper, dude. Yeah, it wasn't cool. Now, actually, my first name is Nell. So I was like, man, I have to swag this thing up. So I was like, maybe I'll just call myself Nelly Nell, which actually sounded worse.
when did you just start using your, well, Wyclef is your...
What, that's my middle name.
Middle name.
Yeah.
Eventually, your father moved your family from Coney Island to an abandoned funeral parlor near Newark. What was he looking for there?
Well, they moved us because he said that God spoke to him, and he said this is where the church would be, the future church would be in this bad neighborhood. We went and he moved us inside of a burnt funeral home, which later became, to his vision, one of the best churches on South Orange Avenue.
Although for a while he was just having religious ceremonies in people's basements.
Basements, and then we had church inside of the funeral home.
Now, you were acting out at this point, getting into fights, stealing. Was it almost predictable that you would do that because of the troubled background that you'd had?
No, I think my parents were very strict and it was very hardcore in the sense of how we were raised. But at the same time, I would say with me, the neighborhood that we were raised in,
still was very tough and very rough. And as a kid, you know, you do things.
And then, but for hip hop, being in Newark is probably pretty good, although maybe moving in the Bronx would have even been better. But there was a guy named Onexus, later known as Old Dirty Bastard with the Wu-Tang Clan. What did you learn from him?
I mean, he was a character, you know, and he was always happy. And I just remember that was sort of like the toughest rap group ever, you know, at the time. Like, those boys were mean, like, you did not. And then we did a show with them, you know. And so, you know, the three little Fugees, you know, two from the ghetto, one from the suburbs. Then you got, like, the entire Wu-Tang Clan, hundreds of guys, you know what I'm saying, from Staten Island. It was, we always held our own, you know. Old Dirty Bastard, who had many names, Osiris, Baby Jesus. The best way I could describe, he sort of, like, reminded me of, like, a modern day, like, James Brown for hip hop. Because half of the time, I didn't know what he was saying, but it just sounded cool. You know what I'm saying?
Meanwhile, you also had learned how to play bass. And were playing jazz bass at times, weren't you?
Yes. Once I came from Haiti, when we moved to Jersey, along with gospel music and hip-hop, when I was in school, one of my teachers saw me playing and was like, "Where did you learn this?" I was like, "Well, I just learned it from the church." And I picked up upright and learned how to read, like, sheet music in, like, a couple of weeks. And by the end of high school, I was practically leading my jazz band. And we went to Pasadena in a competition for jazz.
You said that the way you got past your father's objection to you playing rock was to add the word Jesus or something like that in a song. Did that work for rap?
Oh, yeah, definitely. But you know what? Rap was vicious at the time for him. You know, like, you couldn't necessarily get away with that with rapping unless you were singing rapping. Because any time he heard, you know, he said, no, you can't do this. This is drug dealer music. I don't want you doing this. You know, so you had to, like, sweeten it up and put tones into it.
Which probably helped you.
It helped me a lot. You know, that I guess that's why I'm able to be like, I was gone till November. I was, you know, I learned. I said, man, I got to find a way to do pleasant rap.
Also, you, your father was right. There was a serious drug culture that you were growing up in. How did you escape all of that? Was it just the music?
Well, I think that parents and the neighborhood plays an important role. At the time, you're not just being raised by your parents. You know, coming from West Indian and Caribbean background, even though I'm being raised by my mother and father, if I did something wrong shoplifting, they took me to my grandma. My grandmother gave me a beating. Then when they done with my grandmother, they bring me to my uncle. My uncle give me another beating. So at the end of the day, you got, like, seven different beatings of love, you know what I'm saying, from seven family members.
It gives a whole new meaning to the phrase nuclear family in this case.
Definitely. The West Indians didn't play.
So then you start thinking about becoming a professional musician. And you connected with Jan Berger, who is a rep from RCA Records. Was that something that you pursued?
No, because she was searching for talent, and she had heard about us through this other manager that we had, and we were young at the time, and she basically came and started us off.
And then you also met Lauryn Hill, and that was the key here.
Yeah, so I was in my last year of high school, and I got a call from Prize at the time, and he was like, he's in the studio with two girls. And at the time, the two girls was actually Lauryn Hill and the other one was Marcy. Two incredible vocalists. But we all teenagers. So when Prize says he's in the studio with two women, do I want to come back? You know, as a hot-blooded teenager, I'm just like, yo, man, how the girls look, man? You know, he's like, man, they're fine. I said, I'm on my way, you know, thinking I'm just going to meet some girls and ended up forming the Fugees.
And did you know from the start that you could work together?
It was more a natural vibe because I walked in and I was the preacher's son. So I have a certain arrogance about me coming, being the preacher's son and performing in front of congregations and having this real cockiness about me. So when I saw the girls, to be honest with you, I just, I got on the mic to just show off and to show them how great I was, and maybe one of them would date me. This is how this whole thing started, you know. And then later, whatever was recorded on that tape, the producer at the time, Khalees Bayan, who everyone who's a fan of Kool & the Gang, so it was two brothers, it was Kool & Khalees, did all of the Kool & the Gang music, Jungle Boogie. This was like the Fugees' first producer. And he was like, you know, there's a chemistry here. And this is sort of like what led us to bigger things.
My guest is Wyclef Jean. He's written a memoir with the help of Anthony Bosa called Purpose, An Immigrant Story. It's published by It Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Obviously, there was another kind of chemistry there because you and Lauryn Hill got involved not only professionally but also on another level, romantically. Did that complicate things when you were working together?
Yeah, I mean,
because you know, because it's often a problem when people work in the same office.
Yeah, but you know what? See, the thing about my book is I just had to be raw and honest. So when people read it, because whether if you are working with a secretary and you see her 24/7 and she's doing your paperwork, you spending more time with the secretary at the time than you're spending home. And this is going on for years. Eventually, something might happen. So now, what I want you to think about is teenagers being in the studio every day, every night, every second. So something was bound to happen.
Although you had just gotten married to another woman.
Yes. I got married, definitely. I was married with the love triangle of something definitely was going to happen because I was married, right? Very young. And at the same time, every day I'm in the studio with Lauryn.
You talk about the difference between the sound of albums that are made in the studio and live performances. Why didn't you just do live recordings if you thought that they were more exciting?
Because I felt like live recording should be recorded when you're doing a live concert. And I felt the studio versions was as important, you know. Being a fan of like Bob Dylan, Jimi Hendrix, the two share their own space, Carlos Santana. So I think sometimes there are things that you can capture live that you can't capture in the studio. The studio is more concentrated into a specific sound that you're looking for. Live, you're just impromptu.
Well, you were already writing your own material as well, but some of your biggest hits were covers of other people's songs, Killing Me Softly, No Woman, No Cry, Ready or Not. Kind of made into hip-hop versions.
Yeah, but the biggest song of all times, the biggest pop song of all times, I did write, and it actually broke Elvis and Michael Jackson's record. It's the song I wrote for Shakira, Hips Don't Lie. Mm-hmm. That actually was the biggest pop song of all times. Why do I cover songs? Because I had wished that I wrote those songs. You know what I'm saying? So, like, No Woman, No Cry, Killing Me, like, those songs. I said, man. And so even like Jimi Hendrix, who used to cover a lot of Dylan songs, I think we cover things because we're like, man, I wish that I wrote this.
You recorded the Fugees landmark record, the score, at a time when bands were using multi-million dollar recording studios, yet it doesn't sound like that was the best way to describe the place you recorded this, the Booga Basement, the East Orange studio where you lived and worked.
Yeah, the Booga Basement was my uncle's basement because my dad kicked me out the church. So I was living out of my uncle's basement. And then I called it the Booga Basement, right? You got to pay attention to this swag, man. The reason why we called it the Booga Basement is because when you are kids and picking boogers from your nose is like the nastiest thing. And this was the most funkiest studio in the world, meaning the bass is so nasty. When you hear the Booga Bass, man, it's so nasty, man.
So now the back of the your blurb about you on the back says what does it say about the Fugees? Former member of the hip hop trio, the Fugees. Does that mean that you never will get together again?
I mean, we could never say never. I just think that was a chapter of my life that existed. I've seen rock bands get together like 30, 35 years later. So I don't think that I've never said never, but currently it's definitely former member.
Well, in an interview in 2007, you told Blues and Soul magazine that Lauryn Hill needed to address some psychological issues before the Fugees could have a meaningful reunion. Has she worked them out?
I don't really know. I just know that the past couple of months she's been going through a rough time in the press, you know. And, I mean, we all have it in this industry. Like, we've all been through rough times and stuff. So I just hope she gets better.
Now, in April 2010, you gained a lot of attention when you announced that you wanted to run for president of Haiti. Did you know that that Haitian law wouldn't allow you to do that?
Well, the thing about it is the first part of Haitian law, which everyone should pay attention to, is before 5 years, when they said I had no residency in the country, I was a diplomat, an ambassador at large. My job was not to stay in Haiti, is to promote Haiti outside of Haiti. So how can you be a diplomat and an ambassador at large to promote the country with a proof of a passport that I have, and then you automatically change it and says, well, you have to physically be in the country for 5 years? That is a bogus statement. It's not true. It don't stand.
And why do you think that they did that to you? Because they didn't respect you because you were a recording artist and not a politician? Haiti's had a lot of problems with its professional politicians over the years. In fact, people often wonder why somebody just can't come in there and straighten things out. Did you think that you could actually right all of the problems of Haiti?
No, but what I did was when I got a chance to come to America, I studied people like Gandhi, people like Martin Luther King, people like Nelson Mandela, people like Stephen Biko. And I just felt 40 years from now, a change can happen. But if we don't start the change now, then ain't no change going to happen.
But I remember when Aristide was being compared to Gandhi, he turned out to be a real disappointment the two times he was president. Mm-hmm. He might say it was because he was just fighting just too much institutional interaction.
Yeah. So I think in my position, keep in mind, they bamboozled me before I even got a chance to run. So let me explain to you my policy real quick, 2 seconds. So basically, for me, 80% of a population is living on less than $2 a day. At the time, prior to Aristide, I'm still the most famous Haitian in the world since like Toussaint L'Ouverture. My thing was agribanks, agriculture. What is the two things that we possess in Haiti? Human capital and the soil. So why can't we work on better policy and legislation to strengthen that first?
And you try to make an impact through an organization you founded, Yele Haiti Foundation. But then 2011, the New York Post said that some money had been mishandled. Nobody ever said you were involved in that. But has that been worked out? Has that been straightened out?
Definitely. It has been straightened out. I addressed it on Oprah. And one of the things that
Oprah and this show.
Yeah, of course. This show is way bigger, of course. So, and then.
Well, we're still on the air.
That's right. You're still killing it. Ooh, you know what? I'm going to put you definitely in my rap songs, man. You got punchlines for days. So definitely address that, because when you start an organization and you decide that you're going to be part of it, you have to make sure that the people around it are running it. So I didn't turn a finger and says this or that. Everything that was adjust, the governance, we got it better, brought in better accountants, and then we worked the problem out.
So what are you doing these days? Working on more musical projects or devoting yourself mostly to Haiti?
No, I have, we have a president in Haiti, Michelle Martelly. Right now, I have a new label with my little brother. The label's called All Hands on Deck, and we are developing a lot of young talent that you will see on the billboard pretty soon.
Wyclef Jean also is hoping to be on the bestseller list with his new memoir called Purpose, An Immigrant Story. It's published by It Books. We're going to go out with a song, Yele, from Le Carnival.
Thank you.
Bonjour, voyons un message pour Haïti, Miami, le monde entier, Canada. Good bad boy, yo. Tendez. Sou gen zorey tande, sou gen bouche pale,
si e basan, peyi an li va koule, kan kou yon bato ki plen refije, sinon pa chanje, bon Dieu, ankor, sou gen zorey tande, sou gen bouch pale, si e basan, peyi nan li va koule, kan kou yon bato ki plen refije, Israel chache bon Dieu, tande,
Jimil Sakay, Gade tout se timon, pe a priye, me yo pa presisite, mama rele, me kadav pa katande,
zengle nou pase, mwen tande blou, 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 sou gen zorey tande, sou gen bouj pale, si e pasan, Peyi non li pral poule, kan kou yon bato ki plen refije. Ayisyen, chache bon Dje, ankor, sou gen zorey tande, sou gen bouj pale, si e pasa, peyi non li va poule, kan kou yon bato ki plen refije.
When he was here in September, Wyclef Jean sat down at the piano in our green room and gave an impromptu performance. There's a video of it on our show page at WNYC.org. Coming up next, director Penny Marshall talks about her life and career in front of and behind the camera. And then later on, Linda Hirschman tells the story of the gay rights movement in this country. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.